We shift now to Buddhism. And you know, the first thing to understand is that it grew out of Hinduism. It has the same schema then, the one that I did of the relation of the divine to the not divine, the world of Maya, is included within the being of Brahmanatman, the divine. That's the Hindu term. The most Buddhists and Buddha himself don't like giving a term like that to the divine being because they're afraid that it will still convey that the divine being is an individual or maybe even a person. And so they prefer terms like nothingness, not a thing. They don't literally mean there's nothing at all that's there. There's the divine being, but it's not like anything, and it has no quality that you could possibly know or conceive of. So they talk about nothingness, suchness. Dharmakaya is another term, and there are many more that Buddhists use. The schema is basically the same, and many of the main major concepts are the concept of karma, the kind of fate that drives you, and samsara, the cycle of rebirth that determines reincarnation, which is what we're trying to escape from. And it includes the idea that what stands in the way of the escape is attachment to the illusory world instead of to being absorbed into Brahmanatman, in nirvana. Those ideas remain, but Buddha has a lot of changes to introduce as well. And we have to, in order to understand those, go back to the life of the man, which has a great deal of bearing on what he came to teach. He's a real person, all right. His real name was Siddhartha Gautama. He was born in Nepal, somewhere around 563 years before Christ was, and born into a wealthy family. In fact, lots of stories have grown up around Buddha, and some of them are fanciful. It's hard to sort out which genuinely reflect his life and which don't, but there's a core of them that seem to be pretty reliable. And what they tell us is that his father was so wealthy, had an estate so big that in his youth, Siddhartha never left it. He never saw the world as it is, with poverty and disease and grief and sorrow and so on. His father wanted him to protect him from all of that. I mean, it produced exactly the wrong result. It was counterproductive, because one day he did leave his father's estate, and when he got to villages and towns and saw people in abject poverty, starving to death, and he saw the filth and the squalor and diseased people, children, he was so appalled that he decided to become a monk and leave his father's estate permanently. One of the stories reads a bit like this. In all the beauty of my early prime, with a wealth of coal black hair, untouched by gray, despite the wishes of my parents who cried and lamented, I cut off my hair and beard and put on the yellow robe and went out to become a mendicant, homeless, to beg for my living and to seek enlightenment and to achieve nirvana. And the stories tell us that he did this for 6 years and had five companions that were fairly constant companions. And they tried everything. And Buddha was the most assiduous of all in keeping the strict discipline and in asceticism. Asceticism means repressing bodily desires. That includes for food and drink and sleep and repressing the body. And he got to the point where he was down to eating just one tiny fruit a day. And he looked like skin and bones. And he went down to a river for some water and collapsed. And his friends thought he has died. I wonder if he achieved nirvana. But when they went down to get him, he came to and sat up. And the thought that struck him was, why is it that if I have sought so hard for nirvana and repressed my body so greatly that I nearly died, and I still haven't achieved it, why is that? Why have I failed? And he came back left the water and came and sat under a tree, a banyan tree, there in the deer park, which is where the wandering monks, the begging monks had gone. And he sat there and said, I'm going to sit here until I get the answer. I want enlightenment, and I'm going to sit here till it comes. So he sat there and meditated. And then when the answer came to him, it was so apparent on his face that the other monks immediately knew that something had changed and that he had gained great enlightenment. And the story is that the great enlightenment is itself rather simple. It's desire. He was so desirous of achieving nirvana and so desirous of repressing his body and so desirous of achieving the meditative state of a trance that would transport him to nirvana, that his own desire got in its own way. That it's desire itself that had to be given up, shunned. It's not enough to reject any attachments to the world, which is mere illusion, and to other people, which are parts of that world and also a mere illusion. But one must give up desiring anything. Now, this is a tricky bit, because what it means is that you have to shift from desiring nirvana to desiring not to desire. And Buddhism is very aware of the irony of that. You shift and then you try to divest yourself of all desire whatsoever of anything. That was the enlightenment. He regarded it as the middle path between the extreme asceticism of world rejection and accepting the world as real and just living in it and paying no attention to the soul's destiny, and so on. So he began to preach this doctrine to his five companions. And this act on his part, Buddhists refer to as Buddha love. The act was done in order to help his friends. Their point is that at that point he was enlightened and he could have achieved nirvana instantly. But instead, he decided to stay among his friends and other people and to preach this new doctrine of that the way to enlightenment was the repression, the divestation of desire. And so he preaches a sermon often referred to as the discourse in the Deer Park. And he explains it to them. And they instantly see that he has been enlightened and that he could have achieved nirvana right then and there, but didn't for their sake. He still, of course, is going to live a life in which bodily desires are kept under control, but he's not thinking any longer that by nearly starving himself to death, he's coming closer to nirvana. So he sets in motion now the wheel of the Dharma, of the duties, of seeing what sort of life one should live in the awareness that the world around us is maya, is illusion. Now, I mentioned several points when I covered Hinduism that contrast with what grows here out of Buddhism. Buddhism is, in a way, a reform of the Hindu view of life, but there are certain things that it clearly rejects. Buddhists, unlike Hindus, take the doctrine of the world is illusion very seriously. They don't think that it's possible to have genuine science about the world, because the world is illusory. It is not able to be rationally understood. Reality is self-contradictory. Reality has all kinds of craziness about it. Ordinary common sense reality. It's not real. And so they will not tolerate someone saying, well, I'm a pious Buddhist, I'm here to achieve nirvana, and so on. But I'm going to do scientific experiments in my spare time or something like that. No, that's to invest non-reality with reality. That's what's wrong. That's attachment. That's desire. That's part of what has to be given up. Another difference is that a Buddhist monk or lama will not bless and participate in, say, pagan rituals and lower levels of spiritual insight and so on. They will not put their seal of approval on that, because that's not the truth. That's not right. Maybe it is true that somebody is practicing a religion or worshiping or whatever at a level which is the best they can do given their level of reincarnation. But it's still not the truth. The truth is that there's only the nothingness, the Dharmakaya. There's only, we should be striving to achieve nirvana. And these other things are false teachings, because they regard other things as real than the only thing that is real. So those points are very great points of difference. It would be the height of oxymoron, of hyperbole, of craziness, to have a Buddhist be a scientist, for example, or a Buddhist to participate in a rite of another religion and give his blessing to it. They don't do that. What came out of this was for the Ten Commandments of Buddhism. There are five of these that are for non-Buddhists, non-monks, and five are for monks. And I will give you their Ten Commandments, but I would add this. In Buddhist countries, just about every young boy is sent to the temple as an apprentice for schooling and to have an opportunity to be exposed to Buddhist teaching. And then he has the choice to make to return to his family and to pursue secular schooling and a secular life, or to remain and become a monk. And they do believe that it has to do with your level of reincarnation, whether you stay and become a monk. That's only a very minority number of people who do that. The, you know, 98% go back and live their lives, and they with the this attitude. Maybe in the next life I'll have enough insight that I'll be a monk, but for now I'm going to get my education, I'm going to get a job, I'm going to get married, I'm going to buy a house, and so on. And then the 2% who stay enter into the care of the temple, and they stay there and become monks. Here are the Ten Commandments. Do not destroy life. Do not take what is not given. Abstain from unchastity. Do not lie or deceive. Abstain from intoxicants. Those are for everybody, the laity too. Now these last five are for the monks, only for the monks. Eat moderately and not after noon. So a Buddhist goes out in the morning and begs, a monk goes out and begs for food, but not after noon. From noon on, they don't eat. Do not look upon dancing, singing, or dramatic spectacles. Do not use garlands or scents, unguents, or ornaments. Do not sleep on a high or broad bed. Don't accept gold or silver. Those last are just for the monks. There's also a very great difference in Buddha's attitude from his Hindu background, having to do with gods. I hope I made clear in the section on Hinduism that the gods and goddesses are all regarded as manifestations of the one divine Brahman Atman. They're not real, but that may be the best way a certain person can conceive of them and serve the divine through these gods. And there are village gods and regional gods and so on and so on. And there are the three big ones, Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva. But Buddha rejected all that. When asked about gods, he said he didn't know whether they existed or they didn't, and he didn't care. And his famous remark is, if there are gods, they can't help you. You are to seek enlightenment and nirvana, and everyone is on his or her own to do it. Nobody else, no other person can help you. And if there were gods, they couldn't help you. It's up to you. You're the only one that can help yourself. He rejected the way of knowledge, the way of devotion, as they existed in Hinduism. Praying to gods and being faithful at temple worship and so on is not going to cut any ice. It's not going to help you get closer to achieving nirvana. Neither is study and meditation. The only thing that's going to help, no rituals, sacrifices, prayers. The only thing that's going to help is for you to divest yourself of desire and live a life devoted to that, and then finally achieve enlightenment and nirvana. So Buddhism has no doctrine of creation, no doctrine about life after death. It has only a recipe for escaping woe and sorrow in this life, and escaping being reborn into another one. Here's a quote from, supposed to go back to Buddha. Bear always in mind what it is I have not said and what it is that I have. I have not said that the world is eternal. I haven't said that it isn't. I have not said that the world is finite. And I have not said that it's infinite. I have not said that the world, that the soul and body are the same. And I have not said that the monk who has attained nirvana exists after death. I have not said that he does not exist after death. I have not said that he both exists and does not exist. I have not said that he neither exists nor does not after death. And why have I not said these things? Because they don't profit anyone anything. None has to do with the fundamentals of religion. Therefore, I don't speak of those things. Now, later on, he did reaffirm rebirth, reincarnation. But he held the strange view that reincarnation is a fact, but there is no soul that passes from one life over into the new one. And we'll come to that when I explain further in more detail that doctrine, because that is a peculiar thing to say. But there are a lot of, as you can see, very great differences that are going to annoy Hindus mightily. And not the least of which is that he rejected the whole caste system as part of Maya. There are no castes as far as he's concerned. Buddhists regard everyone the same, even women. So women can become monks, as far as he's concerned. Anybody can achieve nirvana if they just do it right. This is really going to annoy the Hindus, and it's remarkable that though Buddhism originated in India and it spread, it is very small population percentage of the population of India is Buddhist. Buddhism spread into Nepal and Tibet and China and Korea and Japan. It went north and east, but it didn't make a very big dent in India. That's just a side comment, because our main focus here is always on their doctrine of the divine and how to achieve the right relation to the divine. And for Buddha, that's certainly being absorbed into nirvana. Well, we will return next time and we'll talk about the doctrines in greater detail, particularly the doctrine of no soul passing from one life to another. Be sure to do your reading. Remember again that my recommendation is that you read, hear the lecture, and read the stuff again, and it will get you a much better picture of what the religion is like. So we'll end there for today.